Welcome to the Space Show, Andrew.
Thank you very much for having me.
How come an Australian's working at NASA?
Wow. Well, if there was an Australian space agency, I'd be right here. But there's not at the moment. And so I originally started working in Europe as a contractor at the European Space Agency, primarily because NASA, as an engineer, requires you to be a US citizen or have a green card. I didn't have either of those. So I went to Europe and I was able to get a job there at the European Space Agency. And then after a couple of years, I went to the US to do a PhD. And I thought, well, best way to get into NASA is via a back door, you know, get a degree there, meet some professors that have something to do with NASA, and try and get a job that way. And so I did that. And the final icing on the cake was that I won the green card lottery. So there's an actual lottery for green cards in the US. And because I won this lottery, they then trusted me with, you know, the secrets of the US, and then I was able to apply for a job as an engineer at NASA. Mm. So that was my road there.
Well, let's step back a little bit, back sure. to Australia here. Mm. Where did you grow up?
In Hamilton, Victoria.
And your education path took you?
So I went to high school at Hamilton College in Victoria, and then went to RMIT University in Melbourne. And there I did a double degree in business and aerospace, although the business hasn't really helped me so far, but it was nice to have on the resume at the time. And then I went to work in Europe, and then it wasn't until, I guess, about 6 years ago that I went to the US to get my master's and PhD at the University of Maryland.
So that's quite a bit of a roundabout yeah. way of getting there. What were you doing at the European Space Agency?
So that was a fairly exciting time. I actually got to work on a project that went into space in 2007, and we were working on it was called YES-2. So the YES stands for Young Engineers Satellite, and there was some 200 or 300 people working on it, mostly masters, PhD students from Europe, and also some young graduates. And so what it was we wanted to bring something back to Earth using a space tether. So it was a 30-kilometer piece of string that we deployed, just like if you think that the string is wrapped around like a reel of cotton, and then if you just pull it off one end, that's essentially what we did. So we had a payload on one end, and we ejected it with some springs, and that started pulling it off the cotton reel, essentially. And then 30 kilometers later, we cut the tether, and because the two bodies are sharing the same orbit prior to the cut, the body on the bottom is going slower than it would need to be to stay in that orbit. And so when you cut it, it's suddenly going too slow to stay in orbit, and so it tends to come down. And so the idea was we wanted to bring back to Earth the thing on the bottom of the tether. And so we got the Guinness World Book of Records for the largest man-made space structure. It was very exciting. So we deployed that thing, 30-kilometer string, but unfortunately we didn't hear from the capsule that was supposed to come back. So it may be sitting in a Russian farmer's backyard or something, we don't know. It's supposed to hit land in Russia, but we never heard from it.
No signal, nothing?
No signal. It's supposed to transmit a beacon or something like that, but nothing, no. So may have burnt up, who knows.
Now, when you say a piece of string,
right?
It's not made of hemp string, of course. Right. What's it made of?
It's made of Dyneema, which is like kite string. So the people that use the big power kites to kite surf and stuff, it's very similar to that. So I think it was a 0.8 millimeters thick, and it could support about, in 1G, it could support about 40, I forget if it was 40 newtons or 40 kilograms, one of those numbers, which is a factor 10
big
out.
Big difference. But, yeah, 400 newtons.
But it wasn't very strong, but strong enough to hold a kite, I guess. Mm-hmm. And in space, the forces on the, I think it was, it could hold up to 40 newtons, so it wasn't very strong. But during the deployment, because the only thing that's putting some tension in that string is the difference in gravity because the thing's so long. And so those forces are really small, so the biggest tension we got in that string during deployment was 3 newtons. So,
and that's been a problem with other satellites they've tried to deploy on a string like that, tethered satellites. Right. Some of them have gotten out of control, haven't they?
A lot of them have had problems with the deployer. So the one we made was based on a successful deployer that had been used by the Americans. And that is just where you wrap it around a spool and pull it off one end. So it's a kind of passive deployment. The ones which use an active, like fishing reel deployment, so they actually turn a reel and wind the thing out, they almost always have problems. And sometimes it's related to the design of the mechanism, but sometimes it's just unlucky. It's some other problem. But tethers have a bad reputation, unfortunately. So they're great solutions for many problems, but the politics behind tethers is tricky. So a lot of people prefer to stick with traditional chemical rockets and such like that.
Yes, of course, if you do it in reverse, you can actually boost the payload to a higher altitude and possibly even escape.
That's right. So the thing on the top of our tether was actually a Russian Photon M module or something like that, Photon module, and it got a small boost, and you could actually measure the change in its orbit after we cut the tether. So that was pretty cool to see. We actually demonstrated that.
And, of course, the Photon spacecraft is a derivative of the Vostok that Yuri Gagarin flew in.
Yeah, it looks exactly like Yuri Gagarin spacecraft. So we just strapped our deployer onto the outside of it, onto the battery pack, so we were fully isolated from the rest of their spacecraft. And then, so the Europeans don't have their... they don't have a very good way. I guess they have the Ariane rockets, but they also make a lot of use of the Soyuz rockets to launch experiments into space. So I think they hired one of these Photons to do 2 weeks of zero-gravity experiments, and then we were one of them.
And when did this fly?
2007 in September. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are there any more YES satellites being built?
Sadly, no. YES-1 was a similar experiment, and it went up on the Ariane 5, one of the first flights. Instead of them using concrete, to simulate the mass of something they wanted to launch into space, they said, "Well, why not make a real mission?" And so they threw together YES-1, which was also a 35 kilometer tether. But at the last minute, they changed the orbit of Ariane 5, and it wasn't going to be safe to deploy the tether. And so it's sitting up there on a spent stage wound around a spool. So we never got to deploy it, unfortunately. And YES-3, there's been plans for it, but there's no political or monetary funding behind it, support, unfortunately.
Yes. Well, for student payloads, of course, they're now moving into CubeSats and things like that, aren't they?
Yeah. It's a bit more accessible, the CubeSat. It's smaller, less massive, and certainly simpler than the thing we had. So,
So you get to the United States, the Goddard Space Flight Center, which is where, by the way?
It's just outside Washington, D.C., So Washington, D.C. is bordered by Maryland on one side and Virginia on the other. And so I live in the center of Washington, D.C., and then it's just a short 20-minute commute against traffic out into Maryland. Where NASA
Yeah, because most of the traffic that time
is heading into the politicians
Washington,
coming in.
It's also a short bus ride, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. I think you get there with the metro or the bus, yeah.
So what was your job at the Goddard Space Flight Center?
My job is I'm one of the senior guidance, navigation, and control engineers. So what we are working on is we're making a truck, essentially a refueling truck, to go up into space and refuel satellites in geosynchronous orbit, so weather satellites and telecommunication satellites. So usually these sort of satellites, like the ones owned by Optus, after 10 years or so, or 15 years, they run out of fuel because they need a small amount of fuel to keep in the same point above Australia or wherever they want to point at on the ground. And usually they just build a new one. And that's fine if they think they need to upgrade the avionics, but a lot of the time they don't. all they're interested in is, you know, using the dish or whatever to relay signals, or you know, just using the hardware that's up there. So our proposal, and it's quite heavily funded too by NASA at the moment, is to charge customers to get a tank of fuel. And so I think, you know, they're thinking about $50 million for a tank of gas. And we'll try and hit up, you know, five or six customers with our refueling tanker. And then the idea is we would also launch a big tank of fuel that's really dumb. It just, you know, contains fuel and that's about it. And then we would, our refueling tanker would go back to that tanker and stock up on our fuel and then go hit up more customers.
This tanker would be in geostationary orbit?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, and there's quite a lot of interest in this. So the Russians are trying to do this, the Germans are trying to do it, and the Canadians are trying to do it. So there's a little bit of a mini space race to kind of capture this market. So NASA's trying to develop the technology and demonstrate that we can do it, and then if we can do it successfully with one customer, then someone like Boeing or some private industry company in the US will take that technology over and use it as a business. So.
Now, the current satellites, such as the Optus satellites, they can't be refueled, can they?
I don't know about the Optus satellite, but none of these satellites were ever meant to be refueled. And so that makes it tricky. So they were never meant to be docked with, and they were never meant to be refueled. And so what we have to be able to do is find these satellites, you know, go up to them, capture them. They don't have any docking port, any mechanism, so we have to grab something on the satellite that's useful to get a good hold on it. And then we have three robotic arms, and one of the arms will do the grabbing, one of the arms is a spare, and one of the arms will unscrew the fuel cap and put the fuel in. But it's a little more than that, because it's not a simple fuel cap. They have to cut through some insulation, they have to cut lock wire on bolts, they have to undo bolts, and then undo a fuel cap. So it's quite a procedure, and they're actually practicing all this next month on the space station with the Canadian robotic arm. So,
I was just going to say it'd be quite dangerous from the point of view that any residual fuel could explode, leak out.
Yeah, yeah, and it's also tricky once you form a connection between, you know, our truck and the other satellite, then the propulsion systems are effectively joined, and so you have to have good knowledge of this propulsion system that you're, you know, trying to pipe fuel to, all the pressures and the valves and everything, so that nothing crazy happens and the fuel doesn't break and go everywhere, because it's not a good thing if fuel starts spreading around the satellite and hitting the instruments. Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned that they're going to be doing it soon on the International Space Station. Mm. On one of the last shuttle flights, they flew a refueling.
That's that exact experiment. Yep, it's called the Robotic Refueling Mission. Yes. And that's a Goddard mission. And so we get to see that in the lab, and they practice a lot in the lab getting ready for the actual mission. And it's on station right now. There's a great picture on the internet of one of the astronauts carrying this big box, which has all sorts of different refueling ports and different insulation and such, essentially a practice board, carrying it to one of the express logistics carriers on the station, so that when we're ready in March, we can tinker around and try and undo some bolts and all that sort of thing. So, you know, usually, or at least in the past, humans were used to do this stuff, but it's horrendously expensive for a human to service a satellite. And so we're trying to do it robotically now that the technology's at a level that you hopefully can do this.
How many people are working at Goddard on this?
About 150 right now. And the robotic refueling mission is certainly a real mission that's in space. But the actual refueling truck thing, which has a penciled-in launch date of 2016... if that is not yet an official mission. So we have funding for it, but not funding all the way through to launch. So if that becomes an official mission, hopefully this year, then I assume the project size will double or triple or something in the near future. Yeah.
Yes. And what launch vehicle were you be using?
Undecided. They tend to want to be using an American launch vehicle, and they want to use all American parts because this is, with the American economy the way it is, there's a lot of political drive to make something that's totally using all the expertise in America. And if it does end up becoming a military thing, they're not using parts from other countries, you know.
Yes, so your customers are not going to be just the commercial satellite operators, but could also be the United States military.
Right, potentially the military, yeah. But at least we have our first customer confirmed, which is the GOES-12 weather satellite. So that's almost at the end of its life, so it doesn't really matter if we, you know, go up to it and then, wreck it while we try to refuel it. That's kind of a test. And if that works, then we'll go on to other customers, which are right now we're gauging interest and seeing if we can get some contracts already signed.
Yes. Now, just explain a little bit about what GOES is.
GOES, I don't know much it myself, but it's a weather satellite. So it's crucial to providing weather data for the United States. It's sitting above the US. I don't really know what instruments are on it. All I know is, what it looks like, because we have to be able to capture it. It has a solar sail out one end, and it has a big solar panel out the other. And it has a Marmon ring on the back. Marmon ring is something that's used to attach the satellite to the launch vehicle. And then at separation, I guess the springs kind of attach to the Marmon ring or something. But in either case, there's a ring on the back, which is a pretty handy thing to grab. So we're going to be trying to aim for that Marmon ring with our robot arm and grab the ring.
Yes. So when we here in Australia watch, say, SBS television, and they have the weather map showing our part of the world, that's coming from a Japanese satellite, which is in geostationary orbit, called Himawari, or GMS, and this is you're talking about the American equivalent of that.
Exactly. Yeah, I guess it also provides, it's an equatorial kind of a satellite, so it's also providing data for South America, I suppose, yeah. And usually, for example, if we are not successful with refueling GOES, the nominal plan for these satellites is they boost themselves up into a dumping orbit, a trash orbit, which is about 300 kilometers, I think, above geostationary. And so if we are unsuccessful, that is what they'll do. And we not only want to be able to refuel satellites, we also want to be able to perform simple repairs. So if we know of a few cases where, for example, something was launched into space and a solar panel got stuck during deployment. And so we want to see if we can provide a service where we can grab the thing and then unstuck the solar panel and see if we can get the thing working. So we want to be able to do, I think it's the five R's, and I'm not sure if we can remember them all, but it's refueling, repair, replacing, so you could replace an entire unit if it's something simple that can just pull out and put a new one in, and reboost if they want to change orbits. And I think I missed one, but I can't remember what the fifth. Everything but the kitchen sink. But it may get de-scoped in the future, depending what the customers want.
Now, we should point out, you're not actually employed by NASA. You're employed by a contractor. Who's that?
That's Emergent Space Technologies. And there's about 8,000 people at NASA Goddard, and 4,000 are contractors. So even though I'm located at NASA, NASA likes to employ contractors so that if they need to fire people quickly, they can, because the contractors are the first people to go. But generally, contractors earn a bit more money, but they have the increased risk of losing their job, I guess.
Yeah. Do you get much chance to interact with the other people there and to hear about their programs, what they're doing? Because there's a lot of exciting work being done at Goddard, and it doesn't quite get the news that it should, perhaps.
Yeah. I don't really get a chance to interact with the scientists, and it's unfortunate. Like, there's so many buildings at Goddard, and they seem to separate the engineers from the scientists pretty well. So I don't have a good knowledge of all the satellites that are being developed at Goddard. One of the ones is MMS, multi-magnetic something. And that's a big one right now. That's a formation flying experiment. So they're going to have, I think, four satellites spaced in some kind of formation, and they'll try and hold that formation as they orbit around the Earth and then take simultaneous measurements of the magnetic field. Then there's GPM, which stands for Global Precipitation Measurement, and I feel like that's the sequel to TRIMS or one of these other rainfall satellites.
It's the Tropical Rainfall Measuring Mission, which is a joint Japanese and American project.
Okay.
Measures rainfall and clouds.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. I know that GPM has some kind of a spinning dish that's a huge challenge for the attitude control, because it spins at maybe it's almost one hertz, or no, maybe one hertz, but you know, really fast, and so they have to keep the thing stable while this huge dish is spinning around taking measurements.
And it's not on the center line of the spacecraft either, it's off to one
definitely
side.
yeah I'm sure it is. And then the robotic stuff, which is what we're working on with this refueling stuff, is it's interesting. I mean, Goddard was always an earth science place, really. And also you know, with the Hubble Space Telescope, they were astronomy as well. But they've never been robotics. But what's happened with the Hubble Space Telescope, there's been four or five missions to service that thing. And the Goddard engineers who developed the Hubble have become experts in developing tools to service the Hubble. So now I'm actually quasi-sort of employed in the Satellite Servicing Capabilities Office. So all the people that serviced Hubble are now working on this thing, which is to robotically service satellites. So it's difficult, because when people think of robotics, they think of Johnson Space Center, you know, and the Canadian robot arms. So we're trying to break that mentality a bit, and you know, kind of get our own niche. But it's tough.
And we're still people think robot looks like a human.
right. Yeah, they have that.
Which most robots don't, of course.
Right, except for that one they put up on. Robonaut. Yeah, yes. Which has the helmet and everything. But no, our robotic arms are about 2 meters long, and we have three of them. So it's a fairly strange-looking vehicle. And these robotic arms, I guess we haven't made a decision yet which ones we're using, but it's highly likely they're developed by MD Robotics, which are the same guys that did the Canadian arms, but the American branch of that.
Well, coming back home to Australia, do you see yourself returning to Australia at some time?
I would love to, yeah.
And we need a space agency, though.
We do. Well, Naomi mentioned there's something up in Canberra starting up, what was it, the Australian Technology something. Basically, they apparently, after the, was it Mount Stromlo burnt down with the bushfires, apparently I heard they replaced it with a centre to do all the integration and testing of small satellites. So that's very exciting. You know, if something gets started up there, I'd love to be a part of it. So,
yes. Yeah. Well, thank you, Andrew, for joining us on the Space Show.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me.